So again, my talk will follow a handout. Can I just start?
Yeah.
So again, my talk will follow a handout, and a handout, and if you don't have a copy, actually, can I ask you to put them somehow in the back, or?
Yeah, I don't want to go around.
Anyway. And I should start with an apology. So yesterday I asked you a question about computational complexity incorrectly. In as much as I understand it, the complexity of computing Kovanov homology using the algorithm I described for a knot depends exponentially in the length of the knot and super exponentially, more than exponentially, worse than exponentially in the width of the knot. So it's still very beneficial to have a relatively thin but long knot. This said, the actual constants are such, you know, exponential may die very quickly, but in fact, the actual constants are such that you can actually carry out the computation for knots up to about 70 crossings. Which is not that bad. Now, if you look at knot tables, so knot tables have been tabulated up to about 17 crossings, and there are millions of them, and it grows exponentially too. So if you continue up to 70 crossings, there are, you know, so many knots that you will never ever get to look at all of them. So the program will never run out of things to run on. Okay? So, new things to run on. This, by the way, in contrast with the A polynomial, so in as much as I understand the A polynomial, the complexity of computing the A polynomial is roughly 2 to the 2 to the number of crossings. Or an exponential in an exponential in the number of crossings. So in practice, other than a few families of knots, so maybe torus knots and twist knots, so other than a few limited families of knots, and a few very small knots, the trefoil and the figure eight, and maybe a couple more, the A polynomial is out of reach given current algorithms, completely out of reach. So I don't think ever it will be, sorry, with current technology, I don't think it will be computed for all of the rolls and table even, just up to 10 crossings. If I'm saying nonsense, please correct me. Is there anybody here who knows better than what I just said?
Which definition of A polynomial do you agree?
It doesn't matter. I mean, use whatever definition you have. There is no definition for which the computational complexity is sufficiently low that you can even compute it for a 10 crossing knot, generic. Okay? And also, compare with what I'm going to talk about today. So what I'm going to talk about today is entirely polynomial complexity. Definitely polynomial complexity. So in principle, you could compute anything you want for a knot with 1,000 crossings. Okay? So, I don't know. Anyway, let me start. So, again, my talk will follow a handout. I hope you have a copy. And since I know you will be bored, I'll ask you a riddle before I start my talk. Okay, so in first year, and then you can think about it instead of listening to my talk. So, you know, in first year algebraic topology, you're told that to study pi 1 of x, which is homotopy classes of map from S1 to x, and they form a group, and pi 2 of x, which are homotopy classes from S2 to x, and again they form a group. But again, my assumption is that a base point, a certain point on the circle is mapped to the base point, and a circle map point on the sphere is mapped to the base point. Okay? By the way, the riddle will be relevant later in the talk. Okay? So the riddle is, why isn't anybody studying the torus fundamental, sorry, the tube fundamental group of a topological space X? So So a tube is, well, here's a picture of a tube. It's kind of an annulus, if you want. It's a circle cross an interval. And you can study homotopy classes of tubes into a topological space such that the bottom boundary and the top boundary both go to the base point. And of course you can compose such maps essentially by stacking them on top of each other so you get a group. So here's another kind of homotopy group associated with a topological space X. Why isn't anybody ever talking about this? Okay, that was the end of the riddle. Know the answer, don't reveal it yet.
Many years ago, Ralph Fox considered what he called torus homotopy groups. It's not the same, but it's like looking at maps of products of circles and things like that.
Okay.
So I don't know, if you look in the literature, you might find there really are occasionally variants.
So if you talk to homotopy theorists, they immediately say something about, oh, of course, any topological space that has a coproduct, a topological coproduct structure on it, define a homotopy group, okay? And there is a classification or whatever, but I mean, let's sort of, this is a question that you could answer in algebraic topology class number one, so, or you could be amused by it in topology class number one. So what's the answer? I mean, I know that there are fancier answers as well. Okay, anyway, you know, the other thing is, I thought it would be nice to start with the worst part of the talk. So, the worst part of the talk is a bunch of formulas, which are not very pretty, I have to admit. Here is the worst. Okay? But on the other hand, bear in mind that they're not very bad either. Basically, you take a matrix and you apply it to it some simple-minded row and column-like operations. Not quite row and column operations, but very similar to that. And the formulas are not too nice, but the complexity of the formulas is, well, you know, it fits on a quarter of a board, and the computational complexity is n squared or so. So, I mean, it's really, really easy, okay? And now for the actual talk, well, the abstract I hope you already looked at, I'll just say that the work is closely related to work by others that are quoted here, and also that much or some of it appears in a paper joint with Sam Kermani, who is sitting over here, and here is a lovely picture of him. And also, let me say that everything I will be talking about will be in a hidden way four-dimensional topology, for the topology of knots in four dimensions, though it will not look like that at all, and only at the end I'll go back and maybe say a word about it as well. And now let me really start. So the subject is to study knot theory. Here is a long knot, so a knot going from minus infinity to infinity. You already know what these are. And really, when I talk about invariant of knots, I always want to extend them to tangles. And there are several good reasons. One reason, you already saw in my previous talk, often once you extend to tangles, computations become simpler because you can use divide and conquer methods. In order to compute the invariant of a complicated knot, you cut it in half, compute the invariant of the left half, then the invariant of the right half, and each of these might be simpler. So I always would like to extend invariants to invariants of tangles. And finally, let me remind you that knots are diagrams in the plane, modulo 3 relations, Rademeister 1, Rademeister 2, and Rademeister 3, and Rademeister 1 I grayed out because it's often neglected because basically putting it in or not putting it in is a matter of framing, a matter of the distinction between framed and unframed knots, so I'll ignore it. Okay. And now let me describe, speaking of knots and knot invariants, perhaps the oldest is the Alexander polynomial. And let me describe one of the standard definitions of the Alexander polynomial. There are many, many, plenty of them. It's actually a lovely topic. There are literally dozens of definitions of the Alexander polynomials and a huge graph of equivalences between them. Anyway, here is one of the standard definitions. So you label the arcs of the knot 1 through n plus 1, and n plus 1 is equal to 1. So I label the arcs, the continuous pieces, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, up to n plus 1. N is the number of crossings, and you get 9, which is equal to 1. And then I form an n by n matrix as follows. What I do is I look at each crossing, and if it's and each crossing will have three labels next to it. The label of the through strand and two labels for the cut strand. The cut strand, the one that goes under. Okay? And then if it's a positive crossing, then in the row corresponding to the outgoing cut strand, in the column corresponding to A, and in that I will put minus 1 in the column corresponding to B, I will put 1 minus X in the column corresponding to C, C again is the outgoing strand, I will put X, and there is a similar law for the negative crossings. Again, this law comes from somewhere in topology, but where it comes from is at the moment irrelevant. The bottom line is that you will get an 8x8 matrix with entries, very simple-minded polynomials in a variable x. Okay? And then you delete one row and one column from this matrix. So in other words, you tell the computer to take rows 1 through 7 and columns 1 through 7, feed it into the determinant function, you hit enter, and the computer tells you that the determinant is the number written, sorry, the polynomial written over here, and the polynomial written over here is the Alexander polynomial of the knot up to a plus or minus a power of x. And that power can be fixed, but I don't think I want to bother with it right now. Okay? So what's good about it? Well, it's actually very, very easy to compute, right? You just have to form a certain n by n matrix and compute its determinant. Determinants are computable in polynomial time. So it's relatively easy. So it's very, very easy to compute the Alexander polynomial. But what's bad about it? So the computation actually departs from topology. So the definition of the matrix was completely topological, even if I didn't tell you exactly why or how, what topology is encoded here. Yet, the computation involves doing row and column operations. Well, okay, one possibility is to look at the sum over n factorial permutations and whatever, but this is, of course, extremely inefficient. And the efficient way to compute determinants is to do row and column operations. But when you do row and column operations, the matrices that you see along the way, the intermediate matrices, have no meaning. They're just sort of random matrices that occur along the way and have no interpretation that I know of. Okay? So the computation departs to topology. So that departs from topology. The second limitation is, suppose I wanted to extend this to tangles. Okay? So if I follow the same procedure for a tangle, what I will find is that the matrix I will get will be non-square. Okay, it will not be a square matrix. And if I will want to assemble two such matrices when I compose two candles in order to get a bigger one, I will basically have to put them side by side with some identification, and then of the rows and the columns, and then I will have to study very carefully what do I need to know about those rectangular matrices so as to be able to compute the determinants of the square matrices that I will get at the end. And the answer is that I will need to know lots and lots of minors of those rectangular matrices. Okay? But unfortunately, and again, I could be specific and tell you which minors, but unfortunately, there are exponentially many of these minors. So if you wanted to extend this to tangles, the invariant will have to take values in a space of exponential size, the space of all possible minors that are relevant of the original matrix. Now, there are other extensions of the Alexander polynomial to tangles. There are various extensions coming from quantum invariants. But again, typically they will involve picking a representation, maybe of GL11, and then this representation will have a certain dimension, and then you take tensor powers of these representations, which is what is appropriate to do when you talk about tangles, then you'll get exponential dimensions. So when you extend to tangles, you have to pay an exponential price. And these two things together also say that it's hard to categorify the Alexander polynomial. Now, there are categorifications of the Alexander polynomials, but they're hard. Okay? So, basically, if the computation did not depart from topology, then you could expect that every step along the way could be categorified, and then you would need to sort of understand smaller steps rather than determinants all at once. And perhaps that would be easier. Also, if you want to extend to tangles, then if you try to categorify the entire target space, you're trying to categorify something very, very, very big. But clearly it's wasteful. Clearly the Alexander polynomial itself lies within this target space, or the computations of the Alexander polynomial lies as a tiny subspace of that subspace, because at the end it's computable in polynomial amount of time and you have a space which is of exponential size. So you can't possibly need all of it. So if you're trying to categorify all of it, you're trying to work too hard. So, well, bad news about the Alexander polynomial, sorry. Are you okay? Are you with me? So let me completely start from scratch.
From those 2,000 definitions of the Alexander polynomial, is this the worst category?
No. They're all equally bad. They all at the end, not all. Most of them at the end with a computation of a determinant, and I and all of them, or well, no, that's not the worst. Definitely no. Lev, come to think of it, might know better than me. Do you know better?
I think what you're saying is that the determinant can be presented as an alternating sum of wage powers.
Yeah.
So of the same linear transformation. So a good idea would be to wedge this linear transformation rather than the sum of all of its wage powers as you progress. I'm just translating the contents of Lou Kaufman and Berseler's paper on GL11. So when you use GL11, the exponentiality comes from the fact that you're taking a product of many two-dimensional representations, but the essence is in an n-dimensional graph underlying it. So you're just trying to keep the matrix and many of its wage powers all together instead of just concentrating on the matrix.
In fact, so you're probably right. So probably what I'm saying at the end boils down to what you said just now, and to possibly what Lou Kaufman knew before. Okay? Maybe at the end I'll ask Lou Kaufman and if possibly they knew all of that a long time ago. Anyway, let me continue and then see and then know. Okay? Oh, sorry. So let me give you an idea for how you construct a knot invariant. The idea will completely fail. Okay, but then I will generalize it a bit and then it will work. Okay? So let's start from a failing idea. Given a group G and and two young Baxter pairs in G squared, so I'll explain what a young Baxter pair is in a minute, but or what the condition is in a minute, but basically these are two pairs of elements, R plus, which is GO plus and GU minus and GO plus and GU plus and R minus, which is GO plus, GO minus and GU minus. And each pair is a pair of elements in the group. Okay? Given two such pairs, I have a candidate for how to construct an invariant. Namely, I will write GO on the overstrand at each crossing and GU on the understrand on each crossing. And if it's a positive crossing, I will write GO plus and GU plus. And if it's a negative crossing, I will write GO minus and GU minus. And then I will look at my tangle and multiply the group elements that I see along each strand in the order in which they appear. Okay? So for example, if this is the tangle, this is a positive crossing, so I see here a GO plus, then a GO, then a GU plus, then a GO plus, then a GU minus. So the thing written just here. And for the second component of the tangle, I will get a GU minus, GU, GO minus. This is what is written here. And this is my candidate invariant. Okay? It will work provided that this GO, that these two young Baxter pairs satisfy certain conditions, namely satisfy conditions so that the Rademeister moves will be satisfied. Now, if you look at it, Rademeister 2 implies that GO plus times GO minus must be the identity. Well, and likewise, GO minus times, well, okay, sorry, that's the same. And likewise, GU plus times GU minus. So basically, you know, you look at a Rademeister 2 and you find that there is a GO plus multiplied by GO minus, and then you, when you slide it away, you must get the identity. So you get that this, that the plus things are the inverses of the minus things. And then you look at Rademeister 3 and you write down something on your piece of paper and you find that Rademeister 3 implies that the O variable, the O G's, must commute with the U G's. So basically, everything must commute. And since everything must commute, the invariant is just a counting invariant. We're just counting how many times you go over and how many times you go under along each strand. And the result is a certain simple-minded simplification of the linking number. So it's not terribly interesting. Okay? But the idea is to generalize the notion of a group a little bit. And in a generalized notion of a group, this will make a better, will be a little bit better. Okay? So, I'm going to define a metagroup in a minute, but before that, let me describe what a group computer would do. So, suppose you had a computer that could manipulate groups. Okay? So, such a group computer would be able to store data sets, and each data set will be a bunch of registers that store group elements. Okay, so here is a data set that contains a register called X storing G1, a register called U storing G2, and also a register B and a register Y. Okay, and the set of all such data sets with registers called X, U, V, and Y is the group G raised to the power X, U, u, v, this finite set, x, u, v, and y. Okay? But you see, a group computer should also have operations. So there should be an operation, maybe I will call it m of x and y with output in z. And this operation should be an operation that takes a data set that has two registers called x and y, and outputs a new data set in which the register x and y got deleted, but instead there is a new register called z, which will store the product of what used to be in x and in y. Okay? Now, a decent group computer should also have a bunch of other operations. So there should be an operation called S sub X for inverting the content of register X. There should be an operation for inserting the unit somewhere. And maybe there should be a few other operations. But I don't think I want to go over them. The most interesting operation is this operation which comes from multiplication. Okay? From the multiplication in the group. Now, this operation has a property. And the property is that if you multiply x and y and store the result in u, and then follow it by multiplying u and z and storing the result in v, then it's the same as multiplying y and z storing in u, and then multiplying x and u storing in v. Right, this is exactly what you would ordinarily call associativity of the group law. Okay? Notice that I'm using kind of reverse composition, because the old composition law, the one written here, is the one which is reversed, right? You have to read it backwards. So I just made up notation for correct composition. Okay? Now, I guess I want another operation. So the main operation I care about is this multiplication, but I want another one. And the second one is, well, if I have two data sets with disjoint sets of labels, so the registers have disjoint sets of names, then I should be able to merge the two data sets. So then a pair D1, D2 of data sets into D1 union D2, okay? And then there are a bunch of further axioms. But let me show you our further properties. But let me show you another such property. Okay? So, if you have a data set P, okay, in which you have two registers, X storing G1 and Y storing G2, then P is equal to deleting Y from X, and then merging this with deleting y from p, and then merging it from with deleting x from p. Right? If you delete y from p, you only have the x variable. If you delete x from p, you only have the y register. If you merge these two data sets, you get the original data set you started from. Okay? But this axiom is, from the perspective of logic, different than this axiom. This axiom written over here, the one above, is a unary axiom. It takes as an input a single data set, which appears on both sides. So you take a single data set on the left, apply to it a pair of operations, and that's the same as taking a single data set on the right and applying to it a pair of operations. So it's sort of linear in the data set on both sides. This axiom is somehow quadratic in the data set, right? The data set appears only once on the left, but it appears twice on the right. Okay? So let me define a metagroup now. So a metagroup is like a group computer, except I only impose the linear axioms and not the quadratic axioms, which amounts to saying mostly that I impose this axiom but do not impose this one. And now let me be more specific. So a group computer a collection G sub gamma. So for every finite set gamma, which you want to think of as a set of labels for registers, you have a set G sub gamma of data sets. But these data sets need not each store a group element. Okay, they need not be actually a collection of registers storing a group element. So G sub gamma need not be G raised to the power gamma. It's just an abstract set which I call the set of data sets with labels in gamma. And then I need a collection of operations just as before, and especially I need an operation mxyz. So mxyz will go from G sub gamma, provided gamma has x and y inside it, and will have its output in G sub gamma minus x and y with z added. Okay? So I'll have all of these operations, and then also the merge operation. So given gamma 1 and gamma 2, if they are disjoint, I should have an operation from G sub gamma 1 cross G sub gamma 2 into G sub their union. Okay? And again, I insist that these operations satisfy the same linear properties as the properties that a standard group computer would have to satisfy. And I think this all will become clearer once I show a few examples. Okay? So example number 0 is the non-meta example. So take G sub gamma to be G to the power gamma. Define M to be multiplication, define the merge to be the merge, everything is happy. Well, that's the motivating example. Okay? Example number 1 is already non-meta. So take G sub gamma to be, so this is data sets with registers labeled by the finite set gamma. So this will be the set of gamma by gamma matrices with entries in your favorite ring. I guess let's take Z. It doesn't really matter. Okay? And then the operations will be simultaneous row and column operations. Okay? So if you want to add one row to another, so a data set will be an n by n matrix with labels on the rows and the columns. So x, y, u, v, x, y, u, v. And if I want to add, to do the operation corresponding to adding register x and register y, I will be taking the row of x and the row of y and adding them. And at the same time, I will be taking the column of x and the column of y and adding them. And I will get a result that would look like, so I guess if this was A, B, C, D, then in the upper left corner of the result, I will have A plus B plus C plus D. Okay? And in the rest of the top row, I will have the sum of the two top rows of my original matrix. And in the rest of the left column, I will have the sum of the two left columns of the original matrix. And the rest will be just copied as it is. And this new column and row will be labeled Z. All the other labels will be copied. And this will be the operation mxy with values in Z, with output in Z. Okay? It's completely obvious to check that this is associative. Okay? Basically, if you add three rows and columns, it doesn't matter in which order you do that. Okay? I guess I also need to tell you what the merge operation is. So if you have two matrices and I want to merge them, and you want to merge them, then their merge, by definition, will be their block diagonal sort of copy the labels. So if the log labels here are x1 up to x5, and the labels here are y1 up to y3, then you'd label the end result x1 up to x5, y1 up to y3. And of course, the labels need to be disjoint for that to make sense. Are you with me? Okay. I hope you are. Okay. Anyway, I didn't even bother to check the associativity axiom, but you can check it. And now let's check the nonlinear axiom. So let's start with a data set with two registers X and Y. So it will be a 2 by 2 matrix with entries A, B, C, D. And I should have labeled the columns as well, but to save space, I didn't. So think that the columns are labeled the same as the rows. Okay? Deleting Y from P, well, strictly speaking, I didn't say what deleting means, but I said any operation would do the obvious thing to both rows and columns. So deleting Y would be to delete the row of Y and the column of Y, and you'd be left with a 1x1 matrix whose single row is labeled X. Deleting X will leave you with a 1x1 matrix whose single row and single column will be labeled Y, and the content will be D. Merging these two matrices will give you a block diagonal matrix, like this. And this is not the original matrix I started from. So this example is truly a meta group as opposed to just a fake meta group. Okay? Claim, if you have a meta group G and a pair of Young-Baxter elements, so what are Young-Baxter elements? So it would be a pair R plus minus of elements in G2. Okay, so elements that appear to live on two registers. So this is sort of the meta parallel of G squared. Okay? So given this information, I can construct a knot or a tangle invariant provided these pairs satisfy some equations. Okay? But at least I can start the construction. So let me explain how. Well, I'll basically do exactly the same. Namely, maybe it would be better. Well, let's do it on this note. Okay? So what I'll do is I'll put two numbers, I guess in red, near each crossing. So I'll go along the knot, and each time I go through a crossing, I'll put a number. So 1, 2, 3 is on the under strand here, 4 is on the upper strand, 5 is on the under strand, and so on. When I come back to this crossing, I'll end up putting a number 12 on it. Okay? Then I'll take 8 copies of my R elements. In fact, since this knot has 4 positive crossings and 4 negative crossings, I will take 4 copies of the plus of R plus and 4 copies of R minus. I will relabel the registers in the first copy of R minus to be 1 and 12. I will relabel the registers in the second copy of R minus to be 2 and 7, and so on. Okay? Now I have 8 data sets, 8 abstract data sets, 4 R pluses and 4 R minuses, with disjoint labels. So I will merge all of these data sets. I have the union operation, so I use it. And now I have a single very large data set with 16 registers called 1 to 16. And then I will apply MXYZ operations. Namely, I will multiply 1 and 2 and store the result, let's say, back in register 1. Then I'll multiply 1 and 3 and store the result back in 1. Then I'll multiply 1 and 4 and store the result back in 1. So basically I will multiply the content of all the registers that I see along the knot. And at the end, I will get a data set with a single label in it, with a single register in it. That will be the invariant. That will be the proposed invariant. Okay? Of course, R plus and R minus will have to satisfy some conditions so that that will be an invariant. Okay? But at least the procedure makes sense, and furthermore, it obviously also makes sense for tangles, because for tangles, well, you just get an output, well, you get one output for the first round and the second output, or more precisely, you get an output in the data sets, in a data set that has two registers in it, one corresponding to one strand and the other corresponding to the other strand. Furthermore, it's clear that there is a reasonable composition law for composing tangles. Namely, if you put two tangles side by side, you just merge the two data sets, and then when you glue ends of one tangle to the ends of another tangle, you just multiply the corresponding registers. Okay? So, at least I have a candidate for a knot or a tangle invariant. Okay. I should have said, by the way, that there are many other examples of meta groups, but I guess I will skip those. But now comes a little bit of bad news. So you see, even in ordinary group theory, the first few groups you construct by hand. Okay, the symmetry group, you just define what it is. Okay, but after that you need operations. You need to know how to multiply two groups. You need to know how to take the cross product of two groups and the semi-direct product of two groups. And you know, at some point you need to know how to construct new groups from old ones. And I need to do it right now in the meta case. Okay? But let me start from the thing that I'm imitating in the case of ordinary groups. So, let me define by cross product of ordinary groups. So, suppose a group G can be written as the product of two subgroups, H and T. Okay? Which are disjoint, more precisely, whose intersection is just identity. Then it's a lovely exercise that G is also equal to T times H. And in fact, every element of the group G can be written uniquely as a product H, or as a product of something in H with something in T, and also uniquely as a product of something in T with something in H. Okay? So whenever you have a situation like this, you automatically get a swap map, where the swap map is a map going from T cross H to H cross T, and it's the map which maps a pair T comma H to the pair H prime T prime that has the same product. Okay? So that TH is equal to H prime T prime. Now, the map, the swap map, has some properties, okay? And the properties, I think, are best drawn graphically, okay? So, I think my preferred colors are blue for heads and red for tails. And then with these colors, the property is that if you multiply two tails, so two T's, and then swap them against an H, the result is the same as first swapping the first tail, then swapping the second tail, and then multiplying the two tails. Okay? And a different way of saying it is to say that if you had a data set in an ordinary group computer that stored, well, at register 1, a variable t, at register 2, a variable, a second, another variable in the group t, and in register 4, a variable in the group h, then applying the tail multiply operation, so multiplication in the group t, of 1 and 2, storing the result in 1, and then swapping, is swapping, and then tail multiplying, and notice that the axiom, as I wrote it now, is a linear axiom. It takes a single input as a single data set as an input on the left, and a single input as a data set, a single data set as an input on the right, and asserts that applying some operations to them gives the same answer. Well, there is a similar axiom for swapping a tail over the product of two heads, and I claim that this information is sufficient to reconstruct the group. Namely, if you have two groups, H and T, disjoint, I suppose, other than the identity, and each one has an associative multiplication, and there is a swap map going from T cross H to H cross T, and the swap map satisfies these two properties, then from this information, you can reconstruct the group G, the original group. Namely, well, the elements of the group G will be the set H cross T. Just the ordinary product of the set H and T. Okay? But the product will not be the product of the simple-minded cross product. But rather, well, I guess the best way to view the product is as follows. If you have a pair, a 1-1 pair, sort of a one-head, one-tail pair, and you want to multiply it by another pair, a pair, two-head, two-tail, the way you multiply them is by swapping one against two, and then multiplying the two tails, sorry, swapping the one tail against the two head, and then multiplying the two heads, and then multiplying the two tails. In other words, you define the group multiply of a pair one with a pair two, outputting a pair three, to be the swap of the tail of one with the head of two, followed by tail multiply for 1 and 2, outputting 3, followed by head multiply for 1, 2, outputting 3. And, you know, the justification is the formula here. If you want to multiply these two pairs, well, first you need to swap, and then you multiply. Okay? Okay. Now, this has a meta-analog. So, the meta-analog should have in it somehow data sets in which I can store both heads and tails. Okay? Because my information is not a single group now, but two groups, H and T. So I should be talking about data sets that have registers that can store heads and registers that can store tails. So a meta by cross product would be a collection of sets beta, eta, tau, where eta is a finite set of head labels and tau is a finite set of so-called tail labels, along with operations, tail multiply of two heads into, sorry, of two tails, U and V, into a new tail, W, head multiply, and so on, and also the lesser operations, and a swap operation, which sort of is the analog of swapping the content of register U with the content of register X, so that TM and HM are associative in the old sense, and so that the swap operation satisfies properties 1 and 2 of before, which again can be written in my language. Okay? And then the claim is that whenever you have this information, so whenever you have a meta bicross product, bicross product, it defines a meta group. And the meta group is defined as follows. You just set G sub gamma. So suppose you want to store gamma group elements, well, that's the same as storing gamma tails and gamma heads. Okay? So you define G sub gamma to be delta of gamma and gamma, so gamma heads and gamma tails, and then you define the group multiply in G sub gamma using formula 3, meaning as a composition of a swap and a tail multiply and a head multiply. Okay? Example. So the example, the first example I have to show is sort of silly, but the interesting example is to follow. So example, define beta of eta and tau to be tau by eta. So instead of square matrices, now it will be rectangular matrices with entries in Z, with row operation for the tails, with column operations for the heads, and with the swap doing nothing. So this example is, well, it's a meta example, but it's not really bicross product, it's just an ordinary product. Okay? But anyway, if you look at the meta group corresponding to this meta bicross product information, it's the previous example. Okay? There are more examples, there are plenty of further examples, but I don't think I want to talk about them right now, but rather, I want to talk about the example that will give you the Alexander polynomial. So, define beta of eta and tau to be mostly rectangular arrays of, well, so mostly matrices, whose columns are labeled by the A, by the head, so by the elements of eta, and whose rows are labeled by the elements of tau, by the tails. Okay? And I said mostly because in addition, I want a single additional element, call it omega. Okay? And it's sort of exceptional, so I'll put it on the side. Okay? So again, the meta group space for so if I want to store eta heads, eta elements of the sort of group H and tau element of the sort of group T, then I'm looking at a tau by eta matrix with an additional element. But the entries of this matrix, as well as omega, should all be rational functions in a certain variable x with a certain non-degeneracy condition that I failed to put on the handout, but now it's on the screen. And the non-degeneracy condition only says that omega evaluated when x is equal to 1, so the rational function omega at x equals 1 is 1, and all the entries of the matrix at 1 are equal to 0. Forget it, please. Okay? Okay, but now I need to define the operations. So first of all, the merge operation. So I hereby decree matrix alpha 1 with a matrix alpha 2 will be to take their their block diagonal sum. And as for the exceptional entries, so for omega 1 and omega 2, you'll take the product and put it here. Okay. I hereby decree that the tail multiply will be given by row operations. So the tail operations will be simple-minded row operations. So if you want to multiply TU, or the register U, with the register V, well, the register U corresponding to it, there will be a row alpha, the register V corresponding to it, there will be a row beta. So for the register W, you will put the row alpha plus beta, and you'll copy the rest of the matrix unchanged. I hereby decree that head multiply will be similar, but with a twist. Generally, where is it? whenever I have a column C, I will define bracket C to be the sum of the entries in that column. So I hereby decree that head multiply will take the column alpha, or the column of x and the column of y, so the column alpha and the column beta, and send it to a column labeled C that will contain alpha plus beta plus the bracket of alpha times beta. Okay? And finally, I hereby decree that the swap operation will be given by the following horrible expression, the lowest point in this talk. Okay? So, namely, well, so I need to tell you how to swap a tail U with the head X. So I will look at the matrix that I have, and I write it as alpha, beta, gamma, delta, where alpha is a 1 by 1, so it's a single entry. Beta is a row, gamma is a column, and delta is a matrix of size 1 less in both dimensions. Okay? And then the swap operation, oh, then I will set epsilon to be 1 plus alpha, so I just take this alpha, add 1 to it, and then the swap operation will map this matrix to the matrix that has as an exceptional entry omega times epsilon, and as the sort of main entries, the things given by these ugly formulas. Maybe I'll just look at one of these formulas just to see how it is interpreted. So for the lower right corner, I will take delta and subtract from it gamma times beta. Remember that gamma is a column, beta is a row, so if I multiply gamma by beta, I'll get a matrix of size 1 less. So just take this sort of rank 1 matrix divided by epsilon and subtract from delta. Okay? You can argue. That's a decree. Okay? And finally, let me define the Young-Baxter pair. So the positive RAD, well, it should be a group computer that stores two heads and two tails, the two heads both labeled A and the two tails both labeled, sorry, the two heads labeled A and B, and the two tails labeled A and B. So it should be a 2 by 2 matrix of rational functions in X. Here it is, with exceptional entry omega equals to 1. Likewise, for the negative Young-Baxter element, it's written over here. Okay, claim, if you take this metabyte cross product, the claim. First of all, this satisfies all the properties of a metabyte cross product, so you can form a group out of it, a metagroup out of it. If you look at the invariant corresponding to that metagroup, using these Young-Baxter elements, you actually get a tangle invariant. So these actually satisfy the conditions that make Rademaster 2 and 3 hold. Okay? So so you get a tangle invariant, which I will call Z beta. When you restrict your attention to knots, the omega part of this invariant, so the thing written on the top left, is the Alexander polynomial. When you restrict your attention to braids, it's equivalent to the Bourat representation. A variant of it contains the multivariable Alexander polynomial, and, well, I could say a little more, but I won't. Why am I happy? So, you see, you might think it's ultra-complicated, but as I said at the beginning, in some sense it's much simpler than the original Alexander polynomial. So, maybe the main reason I'm happy is because, you know, if the original computation of the Alexander polynomial involved walking on a well-paved path, then you have to jump across the river and fit the results into the determinant computation. The current computation involves, so how would I now compute the invariant of a knot? Well, I would take one crossing multiplied by the next one, multiplied by the next one, and so on. So I'll basically multiply quantities along the node, or meta-multiply quantities along the node. And I'll be doing it n times. Okay? So I will be having n stopping points at each of these stepping stones. At each of these stopping points, I will have computed the invariant of a tangle, which is a partial gluing of the original knot. So at any given step, at any given step of those n steps to which I've broken the original computation, I will be seeing something topologically meaningful, the invariant of something. Okay, not just a random matrix. Now, each of the steps, if you look very carefully, each of these steps involve n squared computations. Basically, you have to take a matrix and subtract from it a rank one matrix. That's n squared computations. So each of the stepping it appears to be the same computational complexity of the original Alexander polynomial, because the original Alexander polynomial will take you n cubed steps to go from one side to the other. And now I've subdivided it into n steps of complexity n squared. Okay? So overall, I haven't lost, but I did put n stepping stones along the way. So that's the main reason why I'm happy. Actually, to be fair, it's actually a little bit better than the ordinary Alexander computation, because again, there is a way to split it so that the complexity depends differently on the width of the knot than on the length of the knot. And again, for thin knots, it will be much better than the ordinary computation of the Alexander polynomial. And then a further reason why I'm happy is because everything fits on one sheet, including implementation. So the next thing is to show you the implementation. Well, that part of the implementation you don't want to know anything about. This is just graphics. This is just how to print the output. It's not interesting. This is the entire mathematics. All of the mathematics is here. So I guess I'm not sure I want to go through the details, but you know, here is the swap map defined. So to define the swap map on omega and lambda, where lambda represents the matrix part of the invariant, well, first you have to find alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, so the components of the various rows and columns of gamma, the various pieces of gamma. So here is alpha said to be one thing, beta to another, gamma to another, delta to another. You set epsilon to be 1 plus alpha, and you let the output be omega times epsilon, and these formulas are essentially the formulas from the handout copied. Okay? So basically, the math is, the program is the same as the mathematics. And here is the definition of group multiply. You do swap, then you do head multiply, then you do tail multiply. So it's again, I don't want to go through the details, but it's essentially the precise translation of the mathematics. We hit enter so that it's stored in the computer, and then we start playing. So first of all, let me test axiom number one of a metabolic cross product. So swapping, what was it? Two tails over a head? Yeah, two tails over a head should be equal to swapping, and then multiplying. So I'm taking a generic element. Here is how it is written. And then I'm applying to it the tail multiply followed by the swap, or the swap and the swap and then the tail multiply. I hit enter and the computer outputs true for both sides, for the two sides are equal, right? I'm testing equality. Believe me, I tested the program and it also sometimes outputs false. Okay, I didn't fake things so that it would always happen. It's true. Okay? Next, I need to test Rademeister, the Rademeister moves. Since my invariant is an invariant of tangles and it is well behaved on tangle decompositions, it's enough that I take the Rademeister 3 left tangle, the Rademeister 3 right tangles, compute the invariant of both of them, and check if they're equal. So the invariant of the Rademeister 3 left tangle is, well, it will have a Young-Baxter minus element at 5 and 1, a Young-Baxter minus element at 6 and 2, and another one at 4 and 3, I guess a plus with these orientations. Okay? So I take these three things, and then I multiply 1 and 4 into 1. So I multiply the stuff appearing along this strand. Then I multiply 2 and 5 into 2, and 3 and 6 into 3. These are the three multiplications. And then I do the same for the left Rademeister 3 move. I get two invariants. Both of them are, actually, both of them are 3 by 3 matrices, I think. But my drawing program, which I told you not to look at, suppresses rows and columns that have only zeros in them. Okay? So in fact, the matrices are slightly bigger, and they have a further row and column that are completely zero, and I suppress those because they're not interesting. But anyway, what remains is the same. Okay? So I've proven Rademeister 3, likewise I could prove Rademeister 2, and my invariant really is an invariant. Finally, let's compute... Oh, I forgot to hit enter here, so oddly the computer still works. So, now let's do it for A, let's compute the invariant of A17. So A17, the knot drawn previously, has this list of crossings. I enter it, the computer outputs the invariant of the 8 crossing tangle that has 8 crossings just like 817, but not glued together. So it basically has 8 times crossings put side by side. Okay? The invariant will be a 16 by 16 matrix that has many empty rows and columns. The non-empty rows and columns are shown here, and it's not interesting. Then I tell my computer to multiply 1 and k, put the output in k, as k runs from 2 to 10. So instead of gluing all the, instead of making all the connections that I need to make, I make only the first 10. So instead of multiplying all the way to 16, I multiply only up to 10. The result is a certain tangle, which you could get by taking the original 817 and cutting it in 6 places. Okay? So I haven't drawn it, but here is its invariant. And then finally, I take that, the result of the previous thing, and multiply for the remaining 6 cuts, and output beta, hit enter, and the result is written over here. It's actually a 0 by 0, sorry, it's a 1 by 1, the matrix part is entirely 0, so it gets suppressed by the program, and this is only the omega part, okay? And Alexander is looking at it happily because he knew it from before, right? This is exactly the Alexander polynomial. Oh, so why did I ask you this in the beginning? So, why do people never study tubes? Maybe why do I care? Oops, sorry, I went the wrong way. Maybe why do I care? So, the reason I care is because there is a standard map of three-dimensional knot theory into four-dimensional theory, and into four-dimensional knot theory. And the standard map involves mapping circles to tubes, mapping strands to tubes. And here's how it goes. It's best shown on braids. Okay? So what's a braid? a braid is a movie of points in the plane, right? You have a number of points in the plane, and you look at it, you sort of let them move around, and if you take this movie and regard the time coordinate as the third coordinate, then that's a braid, right? Likewise, if I wanted to describe a two-dimensional surface, or a tube, or a pair of tubes, or maybe three, noted in R4, one way to do it would be to study movies of rings flying in R3. Right? If you have a movie of rings flying in R3, then they span two-dimensional surfaces in R4. Okay? Now, and these surfaces are, by the way, tubes. Okay? So, but you see, rings flying around in R3 can trade places in three ways. One way is sort of the boring way. They can trade places externally. But there is also the lovely way. They can fly through each other. Either this way, green through red, or the other way, red through green. Okay? And in fact, the map from ordinary braid theory to four dimensions is the map which sends the red over green to green flying through red, and the green over red crossing to red flying through green. And you can check that it's a well-defined map. However, it's a map that maps knotted lines to knotted tubes. So in spirit, it's related to, well, it's instead of homotopy classes of tubes, as the way I phrased the question, it's about embeddings of tubes, isotopy classes of tubes. But it's related. So again, why doesn't anybody study knotted tubes? Sorry, homotopy classes of tubes. Yeah.
People do study motion groups, which is very similar.
No, but now I'm asking a question in homotopy theory, back again.
Embeddings of,
No, but then back to the riddle. I'm asking, why do people not study pi sub t?
No, I understand.
So let me answer the question, since nobody gave an answer. The answer is that pi sub t of a topological x is isomorphic to pi 1 of the topological space, semi-direct product, pi 2 of the topological space x. Remember that pi 1 acts on pi 2, so it makes sense to form the semi-direct product. So if you fully understand pi 1 and pi 2, and the action of pi 1 on pi 2, and these people study all the time, then you fully understand pi sub t, so there is nothing new about it. Okay? But there is a moral to the story, and the moral is that it's better to study circles and spheres than to study tubes. Now, transfer this moral from homotopy to isotopy, and you will find that it is better to study knotted circles in R4, knotted circles and knotted spheres in four dimensions, rather than knotted tubes. Okay? And on knotted circles in knotted spheres, there are operations which are analogous to the operations of pi 1 and pi 2. Except, you see, these are not group operations. Because in order to define, for example, the pi 2 multiplication, the two inputs need to be present a priori. They need to be present at the same time. They need to be both embedded at the same time. And only then you will know what to do with them. So what we study is knotted balloons and hoops. So these are knots that have a number of balloon components and a number of hoops component. So a number of S2s and a number of S1s. On such things, which are like the elements in beta eta tau of before, so on such things, there are several unary operations defined. These are not analogous to the binary operations defining pi 1 and pi 2. So there is a unary pi 1 multiplication, which I will call head multiply, which is, well, you go along one hoop and then another, and then another, the second hoop. And remember that these two hoops could have been knotted with the other parts of the knot. So, again, it's not the input, the operation depends on the entire input, not just on X and Y. Okay? There is a balloon multiply operation, which takes two balloons and forms a big balloon by merging them with little tunnels. And this is, well, it's the analog of multiplication of pi 2, but again, it's a unary operation, not a binary operation. These two balloons could be knotted with each other, again, could be complicated. And finally, there is an analog of the swap operation, which is the analog of the action of pi 1 and pi 2, and this is just rerouting the strand of one of the balloons along one of the hoops. And again, it's the analog of the action of pi 1 and pi 2, but it's not the same. You can check that these satisfy the same axioms. You can check, as I wrote before, you can check that the meta by cross product corresponding to these, to this head multiply, tail multiply, and swap gives you the analog of, or not the analog, gives you the space of embeddings of tubes with the obvious concatenation of tubes. So it gives you the image of three-dimensional tangles into four-dimensional knotted tubes. So in fact, the whole story that I told you was about constructing an invariant of these four-dimensional things, which is well-behaved under these four-dimensional operations. And I just told you how to implement these four-dimensional operations at the level of the values of the invariant. Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have time to tell you the other reasons why I'm happy or what my to-do list is, so I'll finish with propaganda.